KZSU FM Stanford. Welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. I am also an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you very much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. And today, I'm excited to have on the author, most recently, of the book Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder. The author is David Weinberger. And in this book, we have the opportunity to explore literally what we mean when we say information and how information is organized. Everything is Miscellaneous is a topic that a title that we will explore initially. But what it gets to in large measure is how information is organized, how it was organized in the past prior to digital and internet technology, and then how it can be and will be organized in the future. And in David's book, he takes a wide-ranging view of various ways that information has been organized, from more classic groups of information like the Bettman Archives, straight through to Amazon and Google. And he talks about orders and orders of organization, and we're going to discuss that in some detail as well. But here we continue a theme that we've seen on Hearsay Culture quite a bit, and that's a theme that basically deals with how information itself can be categorized and how people can access information and the wealth of information that's out there given technology that exists today. Hearsay Culture has been around for a little over a year, but we've had on people ranging from Peter Morville to Frank Pasquale at Seton Hall discussing search engines and Richard Lanham at UCLA discussing scarcity in time and information and the time that people have to devote to figuring out what's going on around them. And here we're going to take really a wide-ranging view of various methods and ways that information have been organized and how technology is changing those things. David's book also is very readable for those that are not technologists per se, although it has a lot to say to people that are very familiar with the field as well. The book certainly is a book that's quite readable for individuals that aren't as well-versed in technology and well-versed in information architecture, and so I recommend it on that level as well. David's background is also quite broad, and in a nutshell, David is the co-author of The Clue Train Manifesto, which is another outstanding book that came out a few years ago. He's a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He's written for Wired, USA Today, and the Harvard Business Review. He has contributed to NPR's All Things Considered, and he's also a marketing consultant. So David has a pretty wide background here when it comes to dealing with these issues and discussing them. So I'm very excited to have David on, and if I've done my job properly, at the other end of the phone here is David. David, are you there?
I am here.
Thank you so much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture, and thanks for your patience in scheduling as well.
Oh, well, thanks for your patience. Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in with the initial question for readers that aren't familiar with you and your background. Perhaps your background in a little more detail that leads us to how you got interested in these topics.
Than anybody ever imagined, and we're actually doing pretty well with it. So another is if you look up one level of abstraction from information, what you see is information about information. And in fact, that turns out to be the answer to the first question, which is, why weren't we overwhelmed? Well, it turns out that the solution to the information overload problem is to generate yet more information, but it's information about information, also called metadata sometimes. And that information helps us to organize, sort, classify, deal with, and benefit from the huge amounts of information that we have generated. How we manage that information about information, who manages it, the way we put it together, are immensely important topics. There's a great deal of power and authority that goes to those who are in a position to manage the information about the information. And so I have sort of a political interest in this set of topics as well.
The politics, perhaps something to ask about. What is that connection?
Well, there's both politics and, usual thing, candidates and so forth, but I actually mean it in a slightly more extended sense of, it's very simple, is that, the people who get to decide what information should be interesting to us. So that's a level up from the question of information, of generating information. The people who get to decide that have a great deal of influence and power, and usually, in many cases, they're not in that position because they wanted the power. I mean, like newspaper editors and journalists tend to be motivated by a desire to make democracy better by keeping us better informed. Nevertheless, simply because of the physical nature of paper, somebody has to decide what gets on the front page, what the lead story is, and what doesn't get into the paper at all. That you simply have to do that. That's the world we've been living in, the physical world. I'm getting over a cold.
Fair enough, you and me both.
Yeah, most of the world is. So, simply because newspapers are printed on paper, and that means the economics and physics of paper means that you get to print one edition of the paper that we all get to read, the people who put together the paper, who decide what information counts, will matter to us, have an enormous amount of power and authority. That's the sense in which I mean politics.
Perhaps it would be good to start off just with the overarching question, which is, what does the title mean, Everything is Miscellaneous?
We have thought in our culture, in Western culture, for 2,500 years, we've assumed that there is a way that the world is. There's a natural order, and it's the job of the wise and the scientists to figure out what that right order is. And over the past few decades, that has come under heavy dispute. You can trace it back a little further than that as well, if you want. But that is the notion that there's a single way that the world is. And so, but we've had this commitment to trying to figure out what the right categories are. How do you arrange the tree of life? What are the right categories for species? Is a platypus a mammal or something else? Is a bat a bird or a mammal? We have these questions. We've tried to figure out what the right set of categories are. Well, usually when we do one of these organizational charts, whether it's a species or you're weighing out your new kitchen, you end up with one box, one bin, that's the miscellaneous. The miscellaneous is where you put the things that aren't like anything else, and aren't like the things that are next to them, right? It's this collection of stuff that has no principle of similarity. And we have considered that box to represent the failure of the organizational system. If the box gets too big, then we say, oh, our classification system isn't working. We better come up with a new one. So we've reviled the miscellaneous. And one of the points of the book is that in the digital world, as we move information online, the old constraints, the old idea that there has to be a single way of organizing things, gets in our way. It's not even, it's absolutely a negative. And so it turns out to be better digitally to undo the work that we've been doing. And instead to say, frequently, just digitally, is just sending this huge pile of stuff to treat everything as if it were miscellaneous, not as if it's locked into a particular category.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean the term slightly differently than usual, because this huge pile of stuff, and you, this huge pile of stuff, for example, is everything that's on the World Wide Web, or if you want, this might be some area, it might be all the books of Amazon, or all the photos on your hard drive, all the digital photos. These collections of miscellaneous stuff are different from the normal sort of miscellaneous stuff that you have in your kitchen drawer for miscellaneous objects, because digitally, and this is the key thing, digitally, things have lots of information about them attached to them, and that information can be used to sort and order them in particularly useful ways.
In the book, and you use the word there, so it's a nice segue, you talk about three levels, if you will, of order, and perhaps level is the wrong word, but perhaps you could describe what it is and what those are using the word order in your book.
So the first order, very straightforward, it's you organize the things themselves, whether it's the books on the shelves in the library, or it's the merchandise in your store, or the photos in your album. Everything has to go somewhere, and everything can only go in one place. Can't have two things in the same place at the same time because atoms just don't work that way. So we organize as best we can, and sometimes we have a fight with our spouse about how we're going to organize our collection of CDs, physical CDs. But we come up with the best solution we can. Second order, you separate the information about that stuff. You physically separate it, and you organize that information. So the classic example is the card catalogs that used to be in all the libraries. Now they're being replaced. Classic card catalog, you separate the information about the books from the books, you put it on a 3x5 card, you reduce the information down to what fits on a 3x5 card. But the benefit that you get is you can walk your fingers through the catalog, it's far more efficient, and you can have three or four different ways of organizing those cards. You can do a subject, author, title arrangement, not just pick one the way you had to in the first order. So those are the first two orders. Traditional, they're based around physical objects, and we're very good at doing them. Now we have sciences. We have a science of merchandise, how to lay out a store, and a science of how to organize libraries and so forth. We're very good at it. The third order is the one that we're in now, where everything is digital, where the information is digital, and the information about the information is digital. So the book is scanned in and is digitized. But so is the information about that book, who wrote it, who published it, how long it is, etc., all the information about it. And when everything is digital, the old limitations that we had assumed would hold forever simply don't. So you no longer have to put a book on a single shelf if it's electronic. In fact, if you're Amazon and you're trying to sell lots of books, then you'd be foolish to take a book and say, we're only going to make it available if you find it in the way that we think it should be categorized. We'll put it into as many categories as you can possibly think of, because that means more people will find it, and you'll sell more. So there are a set of basic principles about how we organize things that change in the third order, and then there are some implications of those change principles as well.
Let's, with that background, I think we can get into some of the development of what you explain in the book. And you open the book by discussing the Staples Corporation and their mock store, if you will, that they use, I guess, to study the very issues that you're discussing, how, in that case, merchandise and other resources can be allocated to best market. With that background, how does the Staples analogy fit through the themes that you describe in the book?
Well, Staples faces the same challenges as any physical store. They're very clever at it, but they have to deal with the fact that they can only put physical objects in one place at a time, even though frequently, if magic worked in the physical world, you'd want to have multiple things in the same place. You'd want to have a big stack of blank CD Christmas fables as an example is that traditionally merchandisers have used physical space against us. So there is a science to making stores inconvenient. They put the most popular items in the back. A grocery store, like bananas and milk or whatever it is, they put it in the back in order to force us to go through the store and look at stuff we don't want to look at in the hope that our interest will get snagged and we'll buy something more. Staples is in the vanguard of stores that are trying to get us in and out quickly for our convenience rather than trying to use space against us. Well, that's exactly the same principle that holds on the web. On the web, if you make your users click through screen after screen in order to get to where they want, because you want to show them stuff they don't want to look at, people will leave your site immediately. So in Staples, we have one example, I think, of how some of the web principles of organization are being instituted in the real world, insofar as they can be, and only in a limited way, of course.
The nature of information, I guess to take a step back, is, at least today, we find that there seem to be two groups of entities. I mean, there's various ways to describe them, but one way to delineate between the groups of entities that are actually doing the organizing are commercial and non-commercial. And obviously, you know, Google being a prime example, and, you know, and you're given university library database, you know, and system cataloging system as another example. Is there anything to, or is there any issue arising with respect to organizing information today that turns on whether the entity itself that's doing the organizing is a commercial entity or not?
Well, in many instances, the commercial entities are well ahead of the non-commercial ones in helping us find information because the commercial entities have an immediate reason to try to get to show us things that will be interesting and important to us. They want to give us as many links to other stuff as possible. So the key thing about the miscellaneous online as opposed to the box in your garage or drawer in your shelf, a drawer in your kitchen, is that the online miscellaneous, the things are linked to other things. One way or another, they're connected. You can get from one to the other, and we're continually building up these links among the pieces on the web, which adds a layer of meaning and significance to them, as well as making it easier to find stuff. So, at a site, if you compare Amazon, which I think is a brilliant example of adopting these new principles, to a typical library, both have a real interest in helping us find information. Amazon generally does far, far better. They provide every way they can possibly think of to surface books for us, and that includes noticing statistical relationships among the books, statistical relationships among in the buying patterns of people, and people who bought this book also bought. And maybe most interesting and exciting, and in some ways counterintuitive for a library, where generally it's librarians and experts who figure out what books are related to what books. Amazon has any number of ways in which readers, just you and me, readers, can say these two books are related, including their Listmania feature, which allows, you know, the idea behind Listmania, which is very simple, is anybody can make a list of books about any topic. They came up with this because they were thinking, you know, these top 10 lists are very popular. And so Amazon thought, well, we'll do some. We'll make lists. And then they thought, no, we'll let our readers make lists. And so you get lists that are really useful sometimes, and lists that are incredibly creative and sometimes really funny on some topic and pulling together books you would never have thought of pulling together. And so they're harnessing their readers and their customers to do the work of saying, these two books are related in one way or another.
And a scholarly interest of mine, I guess, by way of very brief background, are public-private partnerships. And I take a look at that in the intellectual property sphere in particular. But, so I guess this piques my interest a bit here. You know, we talk about, and you talk about in the book, you know, like you just said, you know, things like hypertext and metadata and tagging and all of these ways that one can organize information and how that information can then be used to make it easier to find what you're looking for. And the example that you use with respect to the Bettman archives and Civil War photos is a good example of that. But it does lead me to wonder whether the metrics, perhaps, maybe there's a better word, but the metrics that are being used by commercial entities to organize information and make it accessible differ in any way from the kind of metrics that we might expect a non-commercial entity to engage in. So I can certainly and would agree with the fact that you have that direct reason for a commercial entity to allow access and to have ready access, but is the nature, perhaps a better way to put it, is the nature of the access that commercial entities are allowing any different than what we would expect or might expect, putting aside, you know, competence issues from the public sector?
Well, yeah, I think a little bit. So there's no reason why the two sectors should be using different ways, different techniques for pulling books or whatever together. Generally, the same techniques could be used by anyone. And in fact, there are libraries that are doing some pretty advanced things that Amazon may want to take a look at. Advanced techniques for helping us find what we didn't even know we were looking for, which is, you know, Amazon's basic reason to live is to show us that stuff. That's how they make money. But libraries absolutely want us to discover the knowledge that we didn't know was there. So there are some institutions that do that. There's an institutional reason why it's happening faster in the commercial realm, though. One is just the urgency of making your quarterly numbers, so that absolutely drives the commercial sphere more than many academic libraries or libraries in general. But in part, it's also, I'm afraid, that there is a tradition, a set of values and a culture in institutions, and so by no means only libraries, that value expertise over everything else, and for good reason. Right? We've had to rely upon experts to help us through the mass of material that we print, even before the web, just in the print world. And so we had editors who have done a great job. They're highly trained, and to select out of the mess of submissions that they get, they pick out stuff that's high quality. And librarians also have been our guides to knowledge through the stacks and have been irreplaceable. But this is based upon and leads to, at the same moment, a belief in the power of expertise. Well, online, expertise absolutely has its place. And I would not disparage it for a moment. The thing is that everything has its place on the web. That is, experts can post their lists, their guides, their outlines of knowledge, which can be incredibly useful. And if you've done research on the web, then you let that as we come across these sorts of experts, some of whom have credentials and some of whom don't. But they're pulling together information in scholarly and sometimes profound ways. But there are also many other ways of pulling together information. The scholarly and the expert both have a place, but no longer the only place, and in many instances, not even the most useful place. In some places, yes, but not, overall, their importance has been comparatively diminished because we now have so many other ways of finding information. When we need them, we really need them and we use them, but they're still available on the web. And so there's a sociological, psychological inhibition among the existing institutions, such as libraries, universities, academic journals, and the like, and in some sense, well-grounded resistance, nevertheless, a real resistance to some of the changes that commercial entities embrace far more rapidly.
I take your point. I mean, certainly the stasis that you tend to find in government can be maddening for a variety of reasons, and the motivations behind or those lack of activity on the part of people in government is often you know, the subject of a lot of debate. And so the commercial, you know, the commercial, the profit-seeking, the rent-seeking, however you want to define it, motivation of an entity like Google to get the information out there as quickly as possible, I think warrants that conclusion. But you also talk about, in the book, about the fact that we don't think about as individuals, as consumers, or entity, or people attempting to access the information as opposed to those doing the organizing, about where that information is. And you recount stories of asking archivists where a particular piece of information will be found on a disk drive, and the response really is, who knows? And I guess the question I have there is whether, from the standpoint of those seeking to access information, that whether those issues matter. Should we be concerned about how the information is being stored below the surface of our access?
No, not in that sense. Because you don't know on your own computer where the file that you're working on is stored. I mean, it's in fact broken up into bits by the computer at a level that if you were highly technical, maybe you could track down. But as a user, you definitely don't care that it's actually split up across the disk. In that sense, it doesn't matter. But there's another sense in which it does matter, which is sort of a few levels up. Abstraction. It doesn't matter where on the hard disk it is, but it still does matter who produced it, because we need to. One of the big challenges is exactly how we. So the sphere of expertise has broadened. It's not simply people who have credentials. We have discovered now what we probably always knew, but now incontrovertibly we know that there are experts in just about every field who are wonderful resources and know stuff that we need to know, who may not have traditional or any credentials, and we want to be able to take advantage of them. That's how we all get smarter, by surfacing this sort of thing. And there are, of course, experts who have tremendous credentials, who have done lifetimes of work and research, and we so desperately need them as well. All of them are on the web. We hope all of them will be on the web eventually. The question, one of the key questions, of course, is how do we determine the bogus jerk who pretends to know stuff from the true scholar and expert, credentialed or not, who actually does know stuff. That's a very serious challenge, but it's not as if we're starting off from nowhere with this. So in some ways, the web itself was designed to help us address that problem. You know, the web was designed around links, and links that anybody could make. When we make a link, we're doing a recommendation, and we usually provide some context for the link, saying this is a great article, or this article is, I can't believe anybody would even read this article. We provide some context for understanding, but the web is all about, even in its very most basic architecture of being about links, is about us recommending to one another what we should read and what we should believe. So one of the important sources for credibility is, where did that thing come from? That is, who wrote it? Does that person have A, credentials? B, does that person have a reputation? C, is there some way I can examine what else that person has wrote to get a sense of whether I should believe her or not? So in that sense, the provenance of information often is very, very important. Not where it is on the disk, but whose disk was it and where it lived.
And with that point, we're going to actually take a short break here and then come back and kind of take a step back in history a little bit and talk about a particular ISIS, a particular phobia or aversion that you mentioned, the aversion of alphabetisis, I guess is probably the way to put it, although there may be a better pronunciation. You're listening to Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM. And the author and interviewer today is me. The interviewee is David Weinberger, the author of the book Everything is Miscellaneous. KZSU, for those of you that have listened to Hearsay Culture for quite a while, and for anyone that listens to KZSU generally knows, is a non-commercial, non-profit radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. And again, I emphasize for those of you listening on the podcast that it is KZSU that gives the window and the avenue for Hearsay Culture to exist. So if you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, I encourage you to either go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.org kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or alternatively, you can email the underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And otherwise, I do ask you to keep listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. So we're back with David Weinberg. And David, before that very short break, I mentioned this the chapter in particular that this word comes up in is a chapter entitled Alphabetization and Its Discontents. What about alphabetizing has been an issue in the history of organizing information?
Well, first of all, it's a tougher concept than it seems. It was slow to develop, and it was reinvented a few times, and each time it got lost, you know, and then when it was reinvented, the person who reinvented it would have to explain carefully how it worked, and even the notion of alphabetizing, not simply by the first letter, but by looking at the second and subsequent letters, that's a late development, and that was major science. So, and it's been controversial. Now, surprisingly controversial. I mean, you know, we take it for granted, of course, but it was resisted at various times in our history, including the early days of the encyclopedia, the 18th century, as being irreligious because it reduces God's meaningful order to the simple accident of which letter comes after which. It was thought of as a deprivation of significance and order. It was assumed instead that there was a God-given real order to the universe, which was tree-like. That is, you know, you had categories, subcategories, and subcategories, and if you were to look in the mind of God, that organization would be perfect. Everything would be in one of the categories. The categories themselves were perfectly defined. It's not, wouldn't be any ambiguity about where things go, and it would be not just true. This order would be intensely beautiful. It was assumed that order and beauty and truth all went together. And what does alphabetization do? It's a mockery. It's a travesty. And so there were actually religious objections against it.
And yet it took hold. And where is alphabetizing at this point? Is it subject to any threats, technologically or otherwise?
Oh, totally. Alphabetization is so 20th century. So it's obviously extremely useful. Exaggerating just a little bit, but where do you find the alphabetical order of the articles in Wikipedia? Well, it turns out that there actually is one. But nobody knows about it just because nobody would use it. Why would you look something up alphabetically in Wikipedia? In the Britannica, or another encyclopedia, of course you have to, because it's paper, and the only way through it is to divide it up into chunks, and alphabetical makes it easy to find stuff, generally. On the other hand, it also makes it more difficult to find things, because whatever one way you organize a paper encyclopedia, you will hide necessarily a whole bunch of information. Some of it you'll surface at the end of your paper articles by having a see also. And, you know, see alsos are highly limited. There'll be how many in an article? You know, 5, 10. But whatever the article is, though, you can be sure, just because the messy nature of the world, that topic is in fact connected to uncountable number of other topics. So we'll give you the 5 or 10 see alsos. And information that's in an article that you may be thinking about it so differently that you wouldn't even know to look up in the article on Brazil, because you didn't know the composer was Brazilian, or you didn't know the kazoo originated in that country, or this. You know, it hides information as well. Wikipedia, on the other hand, one of its strengths is that it's not you don't consult it alphabetically, and the topics, if you look at a Wikipedia article, it's, you know what, half the words, a third of the words are typically connected or linked to other articles. And so even just the notion of there being a finite topic that you start at the beginning and at the end, and now you've covered the topic, in the hyperlinked world, that notion of topics is way too limiting. The world is way messier than that. And digitally, we can represent that. We can actually start to traverse the mess and to see the relationships.
How much of, you mentioned Wikipedia, and it leads me to another topic I wanted to explore a little bit. How much of organizing information intertwines with literally making a judgment as to its usefulness or its accuracy? We, you know, Wikipedia obviously comes under a tremendous amount of attack for issues involving accuracy. Simply the idea that it isn't professionally done, whatever that means, so therefore the information itself should be subject to a lesser degree of respect. And in the book, in your book, in the chapter on social knowing, in fact, you list the various notices that Wikipedia includes, including what I think is maybe the funniest one, at least to me, which is a Wikipedia note that says the current version of this article or section reads like a sermon. But those kinds of judgments that are made, we don't necessarily get or we can't ascertain merely by the organization of the information. Or am I wrong to say that? Your book covers a wide range of areas, and even in an hour-long interview, it isn't nearly enough time to dig in as much as I would like. So I do have to jump around a little bit, although the thread, I think, it still exists. And I wanted to talk about, and of course, I don't think we can have this conversation without acknowledging, the work of Yochai Benkler in A Wealth of Networks. And you mentioned his work among other places, but under the heading of shared knowledge and discussing the issue of fragmentation that was raised by Cass Sunstein at Republic.com. So I guess I just asked for your reaction there. I mean, we clearly are talking about categorizing information at a much deeper level than we have in the past when you consider tagging and hypertext and things like that. Is there a reason to be concerned about fragmentation, and how do you think Benkler's work responds to that concern?
Right.
It's just a brilliant, brilliant work. It's not an easy book to read. I completely agree with this. I think, yes, definitely we are better off. Not by no means perfect, but we are better off. If the discussions among like-minded people, the people you hang out with, the sites you go to that are politically aligned with yours, if that's the only thing you ever see on the web, if that's your only experience of it, then that would be a cause for greater concern. Generally, however, we're off at a whole bunch of sites, and we're getting, our inboxes are filled with a whole bunch of messages. Very likely, at least letting us know that there are alternative points of view and other things that people are interested in. And that, just by itself, even if we never read those things, we're better off. It's harder than ever to believe that not only are you right, but that your opinion is so obviously right that everybody must believe it. That's a good, I'm being political here, but I'm okay with that, I guess. I think that's a good thing.
And that's one.
And it's one of the things that Benkler spent some time on, and I'll try to be brief, but he's quite thorough and good on this. It's well established that the web is not a level field where every voice is equal to every other. In terms of opportunity, yes. In terms of how many links go to something, we know there are some sites that have an enormous number of readers and links, and then a huge long tail, so to speak, not my phrase, of sites that only have, well, a handful of visitors, a handful of links. So you look at a map of the web, and you'll see, like, cities, sites that are entire cities, and you see suburbs, you know, smaller ones, and you see little hamlets and villages all around. And so, if that's all you look at, and you say, well, you know, that actually looks like the mass media. There's a handful of people who have hundreds of thousands of readers, and most people don't. And so those big sites are the new media. They're just web-based. And there is something, you know, there is some truth in that, but it's an important thing to notice, but it's not the entire story. And as Benkler points out, those static maps don't tell the whole story. The rest of the story is, if you have somebody who has five readers and you come up with this clever, smart post or whatever, it may get picked up and passed around. It may end up at one of those sites, one of those big Hotham City sites, where suddenly 500,000 people see it. And those 500,000 people will start blogging on their own little sites, and vice versa. So there's actually a circulatory of ideas that simply never existed when there was a mass media. Even though the mass media looks like it's structured roughly the same way, which is from some big sites that get to do most of the talking, the circulatory system for information on the web is quite radical and quite new, and should give us hope that many more voices can be heard.
We have about 7 minutes left, and I guess in trying to bring some broad lessons out of the wealth of information that you present here, and like I said, I think in a very readable and cogent way, I will quote yourself to you.
I denounce it.
There you go, perfect. page 229 of your book, towards the close of the book, you have a paragraph that reads, and obviously in, you know, the larger context we can discuss, but the paragraph reads, freed of paper, we will continue our long march of knowledge, for we do it with uncanny skill. But in the third order, we turn an item over in our hands, noticing its glint and texture, trying to remember what it reminds us of. We make a note. The note is a public link that exists in the world and can be discovered and reused. The result is a startling change in our culture's belief that truth means accuracy. Effectiveness requires adherence to clear lines of command and control, and knowledge is power. You're saying a lot there, and especially in that last sentence, and I think I'll ask you to describe that, which you do, in more detail in the book, but what do you mean that, in fact, our culture's belief in, for example, truth meaning accuracy is changing as a result of organizational information?
And
5 minutes.
So in the West, we have a tradition of thinking that knowledge, that life and consciousness itself is all about knowledge, that we have focused on knowledge as the pinnacle of human thinking. Knowledge is, in fact, obviously very important, and that's why the first part of that paragraph tries to say that we will continue. We know how to know things. We're really good at it, and that's hugely important, and nobody's denying that. that. We will all, the research labs are going to stay open, the academic institutions are going to stay open. We know how to know stuff that's hugely important, and we will, but if knowledge has never been enough. What we really want is understanding. That's what we have always wanted. And understanding is not like knowledge. It's not divorced from knowledge. It's based on knowledge. It needs knowledge, but it's not knowledge. We don't have a plural for knowledge. We have a metaphysics that thinks of a philosophy in the West that has generally said that knowledge is a reflection of a single way the world is. Well, so we only have a singular term for it. Understanding isn't like that. Understanding wants to do something different. We recognize there can be multiple understandings, even based upon the same knowledge. But we base our understanding on which knowledge seems to us to be relevant and important and credible. We take that knowledge, we contextualize it, we connect it with other things, we see relationships, we have insights, we share those insights, they clarify how the world works, and so we have multiple understandings, which is fine. That's our human plight and our glory. We disagree. We see the world differently. We understand the world differently. That's never going to end. In fact, we know now more convincingly than ever, the world consists of cultures that see things differently. Two neighbors see things differently. Cultures see things differently. We have multiple understandings. Our understanding is what we want. Our knowledge for knowledge by itself is useful, but it's not enough. And so the web and the internet, which were initially put to us in terms of an information highway and the sort of infinite library,
right,
as if they were about knowledge. Well, yeah, there's lots of knowledge there, but that's not what's driving us onto the internet. You don't have a billion people joining the internet because they want to be research librarians. We're there to do something else, which is to connect with other people and to share our understanding of the world. That's messy. Understanding is necessarily messy. It's necessarily ambiguous and rich and deep and never fully stated. It's all the things that knowledge is not. So while knowledge remains incredibly important, we literally die without it. It's not threatened by the web. In fact, knowledge is brought to its glory by the understanding that our connection with one another enables.
The book is Everything is Miscellaneous, The Power of the New Digital Disorder. The author is David Weinberger. David, for those that want to learn more about these issues, obviously you have your book. Are there any other resources you might suggest?
I have two websites, two blogs. One is called Joho the Blog, all one word, Joho the Blog. .com. The other one is everythingismiscellaneous.com, which is obviously more directly about the book. I would also actually recommend that people Google Berkman, B-E-R-K-M-A-N, to find that website. It's the center that I'm at, and it's actually a very rich resource for ideas and debate.
And Stanford CIS, where I'm affiliated, and Berkman have obviously have a lot of connections as well, and so it's exciting certainly to have my friends at Berkman on Hearsay Culture as well as to discuss these issues. Well, David, I want to thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Thank you for taking the time to discuss your excellent book, Everything is Miscellaneous.
Thanks so much, Adam.
You've been listening to Hearsay Culture, my interview with David Weinberger, author of the book Everything is Miscellaneous. The show is going to continue to have new programming through roughly mid-December. For those of you that have been listening on KZSU and have noticed that there have been one or two days off, it's been a rather busy semester for this new professor, not only with my now 9-month-old son Noah, but as well as teaching two new classes. And so I have been certainly keeping up with the show, but it's been quite busy. I'm very excited to mention that by the time you hear this show on KZSU, I will have posted the last four programs, and I'm very excited to have those up. They were four really, I think, very interesting interviews with a broad range of people. Professor Dan Solid from George Washington about his new book.
as well as Dean John Garin from Hamlin discussing his book, Own It, and James Grimmelman, professor at New York Law School, discussing some of his recent work, as well as Professor Rebecca Tushnet from Georgetown. All of those shows are up on hearsayculture.com, and you can find those shows there. As well as always, you can listen to the show a number of ways. KZSULive.stanford.edu, of course, is the way to get the show live 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Wednesdays. But you can also get the show by podcast by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on the listen page. But also, I put the newest show, the most recent show, on the right, on the aside side of the front page. You can also find the show by going to Stanford CIS's iTunes page by typing Center for Internet and Society into the podcast search engine, and also through CIS's own webpage and their RSS feed, which is at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Last week, I had scheduled Professor John Walensky from Stanford, who's written a book related to the work that David's done called The Access Principle, Making the Basic Case for Why Publicly Funded Research Should Be Made Publicly Available Across the Board. Again, because of my own scheduling issues, and solely my own, I had to postpone that interview, and so I'll be looking forward to interviewing John and having that show air sometime in the beginning of next year. But look for other guests coming up this year, including Eric Davis, the author of Technosis, who has written a new book on California mysticism and how that impacts the world that we're in, as well as Professor Brett Fishman, who is a professor at Loyola Chicago, who's written and done really terrific work in infrastructural commons and what he and a few of his co-authors call the semi-commons. And I'm also going to be interviewing Alex Wright, who's the author of the book LUT, another book related to the work that David Weinberger's done, looking at the organization of information. So I'm looking forward to those interviews, and I do have other guests that I'm working on scheduling for the early part of next year. As always, I do encourage any comments, suggestions, feedback, suggestions for guests, etc. Feel free to email me at dave@hearsayculture.com. That's dave@hearsayculture.com. Otherwise, I want to thank you for listening today. I also want to publicly thank Chizzy, who very generously works the board at Stanford while I'm on the East Coast. And so thank you, Chizzy, for your work this semester in keeping the show on the air at KZSU, and thank you for helping keep Hearsay Culture on the air generally. So thank you for listening today. Please stay tuned to more of KZSU's programming, and have a great rest of the day.